turned his attention to Robin. You said you smelled a sick odor, and you also smelled smoke, is that right? Yeah? And there was smoke in the air? Hugh nodded. Smoke, chimneys, fires for people trying to keep warm. I think the field you're searching for, if there is such a place, may be near Mary's Rest. How far is Mary's Rest from here? Sister asked Robin. 7 or 8 miles, I guess. Maybe more. I've never been there, but we've sure robbed a lot of people who were going in and out. That was a while back, though. Not so many travel this way anymore. There's not enough gas in the jeep to make that distance, Paul reminded Sister. I doubt if we'd make a mile. I don't mean 7 or 8 miles by road, Robin corrected. I mean that far over land. It's southwest of here, through the woods, and the going's rough. 6 of my men scouted a trail over there about a year ago. 2 of them made it back, and they said there wasn't anything worth stealing in Mary's Rest. They'd probably rob us if they could.
If we can't drive, we'll have to walk.
Sister picked up her satchel and slipped the glass ring into it. Her hands were shaking. Robin grunted. Sister, he said, I don't mean any disrespect, but you're crazy. 7 miles on foot wouldn't be what I'd call a real fun thing to do. You know, we probably saved your lives stopping your jeep like we did. You'd be frozen to death by now if we hadn't.
We have to get to Mary's Rest, or at least I do. Paul and Hugh can decide for themselves. I've come a hell of a lot further than 7 miles to get here, and a little cold's not going to stop me now. It's not just the distance or the cold. It's what's out there in the deep woods.
What? Hugh asked uneasily, hobbling forward on his crutch. Oh, some real interesting wildlife. Things that look like they were hatched in some mad doctor's zoo. Hungry things. You don't want one of those things to catch you out in the woods at night.
I should say not, Hugh agreed.
I have to get to Mary's Rest, Sister said firmly, and her set expression told Robin her mind was made up.
All I need is some food, warm clothes, and my shotgun. I'll make out okay.
Sister, you won't make a mile before you get lost or eaten.
She looked at Paul Thorson.
Paul, she asked, are you still with me?
He hesitated, glanced toward the gloomy light at the cave's entrance, and then at the fire the boys were starting by rubbing 2 sticks together.
Damn, he thought. I never could do that when I was a Cub Scout. It might not be too late to learn, though.
Still, they'd come so far, and they might be so close to finding the answer they sought. He watched the fire spark and catch, but he'd already decided.
I'm with you.
Hugh, she prompted.
I want to go with you, he said. I really do. But I have a patient, he glanced at the sleeping boy. I want to know what and who you find when you get to Mary's Rest, but
I think I'm needed here, Sister. It's been a long time since I've felt useful.
Do you understand?
Yes.
She already decided to talk Hugh out of going anyway. There was no way he could make the distance on one leg, and he'd only slow them down.
I do understand.
She looked at Robin.
We'll want to be leaving as soon as we can get our gear together. I'll be needing my shotgun and the shells, if that's all right with you.
You'll need more than that to make it.
Then I'm sure you'll want to return Paul's gun and bullets to him, too. And we can use whatever food and clothes you can spare.
Robin laughed, but his eyes remained hard. We're supposed to be the robbers, Sister.
Just give us back what you stole from us then. We'll call it even.
Anybody ever tell you you were crazy? He asked.
Yes, tougher punks than you.
A faint smile spread slowly across his face and his eyes softened.
Okay, he said. You'll get your stuff back. I guess you'll need it more than us.
He paused thoughtfully, then said, Hold on. And he went over to his bed of leaves. He bent down and started going through a cardboard box full of tin cans, knives, watches, shoelaces, and other items. He found what he was looking for and returned to Sister.
"Here," he said, placing something in her hand. "You'll need this, too."
It was a small metal compass that looked like it might have come from a Cracker Jack box.
"It works, too," he told her. "At least it worked when I took it off a dead man a couple of weeks ago."
"Thanks. I hope it's luckier for me than it was for him."
"Yeah, well, you can have this, too, if you want it."
Robin unbuttoned the brown coat from around his throat. Against his pallid skin, he was wearing a tarnished little crucifix on a silver chain. He started to take it off, but Sister touched his hand to restrain him.
"That's all right."
And she pulled her woolen muffler away from her neck to show him the crucifix-shaped scar that had been burned there in the 42nd Street Theater long ago.
"I've got my own."
"Yeah?" Robin nodded.
"I guess you do."
Their coats, sweaters, and gloves were returned to Paul and Sister, along with their guns, bullets for Paul's Magnum and shells for Sister's shotgun. A can of baked beans and some dried squirrel meat wrapped up in leaves found their way into a duffel bag that was returned to Sister, along with an all-purpose knife and a bright orange woolen cap. Robin gave both of them wristwatches, and a search of another cardboard box of booty yielded 3 kitchen matches. Paul siphoned the last of the gasoline from the Jeep's tank into a small plastic milk jug, and it barely wet the bottom. But the jug was securely sealed with tape and put down into the duffel bag to be used to strengthen a fire. It was as light as it was going to get outside. The sky was dingy, and there was no way to tell where the sun was. Sister's watch said 10:22. Paul's said 3:13. It was time to go.
"Ready?"
Sister asked Paul. He looked longingly at the fire for a moment and then said,
"Yeah."
"Good luck," Hugh called, hobbling to the mouth of the cave as they started out. Sister lifted a gloved hand, then pulled her collar up around the muffler at her throat. She checked the compass, and Paul followed her toward the woods. Chapter 61.
"There it is."
Glory pointed to the hulk of a gray boarded barn, half hidden within a grove of trees. 2 other structures had collapsed, and from one of them protruded a crumbling red brick chimney.
"Aaron found this place a while back,"
she said, as Josh walked with her toward the barn and Mule tagged along.
"Nobody lives out here, though."
She motioned toward a well-worn trail that went past the decayed structures and deeper into the forest.
"The pit's not too far."
The pit, as Josh understood it, was the community's burial ground, a trench into which hundreds of bodies had been lowered over the years.
"Jackson used to say a few words over the dead," Glory said. "Now that he's gone, they just toss him in and forget him."
She glanced at him.
"Swan came mighty close to joining them last night. What'd she think she was doing out there?"
"I don't know."
Swan had lapsed into unconsciousness when they'd gotten her to the shack. Josh and Glory had cleaned her hands and bandaged them with strips of cloth, and they could feel the fever radiating from her. They'd left Aaron and Rusty to watch over her while Josh fulfilled his promise to find shelter for Mule, but he was half crazy with worry. Without medicine, proper food, or even decent drinking water, what hope did she have? Her body was so broken down with exhaustion that the fever might kill her. He remembered her last words to him before she'd faded away. "Josh, I've gone blind." His hands gripped into fists at his sides. "Protect the child," he thought. "Sure, you've done a real fine job of that, haven't you?" He didn't know why she'd slipped out of the shack last night, but it was obvious she'd been digging in the hard earth. Thank God Mule had had the sense to know she was in trouble, or today they'd be taking Swan's body to the... No, he refused to think about that. She'd get better. He knew she would. They passed the rusted remains of a car, minus doors, wheels, engine, and hood, and Glory pulled the barn's door open.
It was dark and chilly inside, but at least the wind was blunted. Soon, Josh's vision grew accustomed to the gloom. There were two stalls with a little straw on the floor and a trough in which Josh could melt some snow for Mule to drink. On the walls hung ropes and harness gear, but there were no windows an animal might crawl through. It seemed a safe enough place to leave him, and at least he'd be sheltered. Josh saw what looked like a pile of junk on the other side of the barn and walked over to examine it. He found some broken-up chairs, a lamp without bulb or wiring, a small lawn mower, and a coil of barbed wire. A mouse-eaten blue blanket covered more junk, and Josh lifted it away to see what was underneath.
"Glory," he said softly. "Come, take a look."
She walked over beside him, and he ran his fingers across the cracked glass screen of a television set.
"I haven't seen one of these in a while," he said wistfully. "I guess the ratings are pretty low these days, huh?"
He punched the on-off button and started to turn through the channels, but the knob came off in his hand.
"Not worth a damn," Glory said. "Just like everything else."
The TV was supported on some sort of desk with rollers on it, and Josh picked up the set, turned it around, and pulled the press board off to reveal the tube and the jungle of wires within. He felt about as dumb as a caveman peering into a magic box that had once been a commonplace luxury, no necessity for millions of American homes. Without power, it was as useless as a stone, probably less so, really, because a stone could be used to kill rodents for the stew pot. He set the TV aside along with the other junk. It was going to take a smarter man than he to make juice run through wires and boxes show pictures that moved and spoke again, he mused. He bent down to the floor and found a box full of what looked like old wooden candlesticks. Another box held dusty bottles. He saw some pieces of paper scattered on the floor and picked up one. It was an announcement, and the faded red letters said, "Antique Auction, Jefferson City Flea Market, Saturday, June 5th. Come early, stay late." He opened his hand and let the announcement drift back to the floor and settle with a noise like a sigh amid the other pieces of yesterday's news.
"Josh, what's this thing?"
Glory was touching the desk with the rollers on it. Her hand found a small crank, and as she turned it, there was the rattling noise of a chain moving over rusted gears. The rollers turned as achingly as old men revolving in their sleep. A number of rubber-cushioned pads were activated by the hand crank, coming down to press briefly against the rollers and then return to their original positions. Josh saw a small metal tray affixed to the other end of the desk. He picked up a few of the flea market announcements and put them in the tray.
"Keep turning the crank," he said,
and they watched as the rollers and pads grasped one piece of paper at a time, fed them through a slot into the depths of the machine, and delivered them to another tray at the opposite end. Josh found a sliding panel, pushed it back, and looked into an arrangement of more rollers, trays of metal type, and a dried-up series of spongy surfaces that Josh realized must have once been ink pads.
"We've got us a printing press," he said. "How about that? Must be an old knocker, but it's in pretty good shape."
He touched the close-grained oak of the press's cabinet.
"This was somebody's labor of love. Sure is a shame to let it sit out here and rot."
"Might as well rot here as anywhere else," she grunted. "That's the damnedest thing."
"What is?"
"Before Jackson died, he wanted to start up a newspaper, just a little handout sheet. He said having some kind of town newspaper would make everybody feel like more of a community, you know. People would take more of an interest in everybody else instead of shutting themselves away. He didn't even know this thing was out here. Course, that was just a dream."
She ran her hand across the oak next to Josh's.
"He had a lot of dreams that died."
Her hand touched his and quickly pulled away. There was a moment of uncomfortable silence. Josh could still feel the heat of her hand against his own.
"He must have been a fine man," he offered.
"He was. He had a good heart and a strong back, and he didn't mind getting his hands dirty. Before I met Jackson, I had a pretty rough life. I was full up with bad men and hard drinking. Been on my own since I was 13.
She smiled slightly.
"A girl grows up fast. Well, I guess Jackson wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty on me, 'cause I'd sure be dead if he hadn't turned me around. What about you? You have a wife?"
"Yes, an ex-wife, I mean, and two sons."
Glory turned the hand crank and watched the rollers work. "What happened to them?"
"They were in South Alabama when the bombs hit, I mean." He drew a deep breath, slowly released it. "Down in Mobile. There's a naval station in Mobile. Nuclear submarines, all kinds of ships. Was a naval station there, at least." He watched Mule chomping at the straw on the floor. "Maybe they're still alive. Maybe not. I guess it's bad for me to think this, but I kind of hope they died on the 17th of July. I hope they died watching television or eating ice cream or lying in the sun at the beach." His gaze found Glory's. "I just hope they died fast. Is that a bad thing to wish for?"
"No. It's a decent wish," Glory told him. And this time her hand touched his and didn't retreat. Her other hand wandered up and gently brushed the black ski mask. "What do you look like under that thing?"
"I used to be ugly. Now I'm downright loathsome."
She touched the hard gray skin that sealed the right eye hole. "Does that stuff hurt?"
"Sometimes it burns. Sometimes it itches so much I can hardly stand it. And sometimes..."
He trailed off. "Sometimes what?" He hesitated, about to tell her what he had never told either Swan or Rusty.
"Sometimes," he said quietly, "it feels like my face is changing. It feels like the bones are moving, and it hurts like hell."
"Maybe it's healing."
He managed a weak smile. "Just what I need, a ray of optimism. Thank you, but I think I'm way beyond healing. These growths are about as hard as concrete."
"Swan's got the worst I've ever seen. She sounds like she can hardly draw breath. Now, with that high fever she's running..."
She stopped because Josh was walking toward the door.
"You and she have been through a lot together, haven't you?"
she asked. Josh stopped. "Yes. If she dies... I don't know what. I'll..."
He caught himself, lowered his head, and then lifted it again.
"Swan won't die," he resolved. "She won't. Come on. We'd better get back."
"Josh, wait. Okay?"
"What is it?"
She worked the printing press's hand crank, rubbing her fingers against the smooth oak. "You're right about this thing. It's a shame for it to sit out here and rot."
"Like you said, here's as good a place as any."
"My shack would be a better place."
"Your shack? What do you want that thing for? It's useless."
"Now, yes. But maybe not always. Jackson was right. It'd do wonders for Mary's Rest to have some kind of newspaper." "Oh, not the kind people used to get thrown in their yards every afternoon, but maybe just a sheet of paper to tell folks who's being born, who's dying, who's got clothes to spare, and who needs clothes. Right now, people who live across the alley from each other are strangers, but a sheet of paper like that might bring the whole town together."
"I think most people in Mary's Rest are more interested in finding another day's worth of food, don't you?"
"Yes, for now. But Jackson was a smart man, Josh.
If he'd known this thing was sitting here in a junk pile, he'd have toted it home on his back. I'm not saying I know how to ride or anything. Hell, I have a hard enough time speaking right. But this thing might be a first step toward making Mary's Rest a real town again.
What are you going to use for paper? Josh asked. And how about ink?
Here's paper. Glory picked up a handful of auction announcements. And I've made dye from dirt and shoe polish before. I can figure out how to make ink.
Josh was about to protest again, but he realized a change had come over Glory. Her eyes were excited, and their sparkle made her look 5 years younger.
She has a challenge, he thought. She's going to try to make Jackson's dream come true.
Help me, Glory urged. Please.
Her mind was set. All right, Josh answered. You take the other hand. This thing's going to be heavy. Two flies lifted off from the top of the printing press and darted around Josh's head. A third sat motionlessly on the television set, and a fourth buzzed slowly just below the barn's roof. The press was lighter than it looked, and getting it out of the barn was relatively easy. They set it down outside, and Josh went back in to tend the mule. The horse nickered nervously, walking around and around the stall. Josh rubbed his muzzle to calm him the way he'd seen Swan do so many times. He filled the trough with snow and put the blue blanket over Mule to keep him warm. A fly landed on Josh's hand, its touch stinging him as if the thing had been a wasp. Damn, Josh said, and he slapped his other hand down on it. A twitching green-gray mess remained, but it still stung, and he wiped it off on his trousers.
You'll be okay out here, Josh told the jittery horse as he rubbed its neck. I'll check on you later. How about that?
As he closed the barn door and latched it, he hoped he was doing the right thing, leaving Mule out there alone. But at least this place, such as it was, would protect Mule from the cold and the bobcats. Mule would have to hold his own against the flies. Together, Glory and Josh lugged the press down the road. Chapter 62. Under a darkening sky, two figures struggled through a forest of dead pines where the wind had sculpted snowdrifts into barriers 5 feet high. Sister kept close watch on the crackerjack compass and pointed her nose toward the southwest. Paul followed at a few paces, carrying the duffel bag slung over his shoulder and watching their rear and flanks for the furtive movements of animals. He knew they were being tracked, and had been tracked since they'd left the cave. He'd seen only quick glimpses of them, hadn't had time to tell what they were or how many, but he could smell the spoor of beasts. He kept the .357 gripped in his gloved hand with his thumb on the safety. Sister figured they had less than an hour of light left. They'd been traveling for almost 5 hours, according to the wristwatch Robin had given her. She didn't know how many miles they'd covered, but the going was excruciating, and her legs felt like stiff lengths of timber. The effect of struggling across rocks and over snow drifts had made her sweat, and now the sound of the ice in her clothes brought up the memory of Rice Krispie cereal, Snap, Crackle, and Pop. She remembered that her daughter used to like Rice Krispies. Make it talk, Mama. She forced the ghosts of the past away. They'd seen no sign of life but the things that prowled around them, watching them hungrily in the deepening twilight. When darkness fell, the beasts would get bolder. One step, she told herself, one step, and then the next gets you where you're going. She said it mentally over and over again, while her legs continued to carry her like the laboring movement of a machine. She held her satchel close, and her left arm had cramped and locked in that position, but she could feel the outline of the glass ring through the leather, and she drew strength from it as surely as if it was her second heart.
Swan, she thought, who are you? Where do you come from?
And why have I been led to you, if indeed it was a girl named Swan that the dreamwalk path had brought her to? Sister had no idea what she'd say to the girl.
Hello, she practiced. You don't know me, but I've come halfway across the country to find you, and I sure hope you're worth it, because, Lord, I want to lie down and rest.
But what if there was no girl named Swan in Mary's Rest? What if Robin had been wrong? What if the girl was only passing through Mary's Rest and might be gone by the time they arrived?
She wanted to pick up the pace, but her legs wouldn't allow it.
One step and then the next, gets you where you're going.
A scream from the woods to her left almost shocked her out of her boots. She whirled to face the noise, heard the scream become the shrill wail of a beast, and then a muttering, chuckling noise like a hyena might make. She thought she saw a pair of greedy eyes in the gloom. They gleamed balefully before receding into the forest.
"We haven't got much more light," Paul told her. "We should find a place to camp."
She gazed toward the southwest, nothing but a tortured landscape of dead pines, rocks, and snowdrifts. It looked like a cold day in hell. Wherever Mary's Rest was, they weren't going to reach it today. She nodded, and they started searching for shelter. The best they could find was a narrow niche in a hollow surrounded by rough-edged boulders. They pushed the snow away to expose the earth and form a 3-foot-high snow wall circling them. Then Paul and Sister went to work gathering dead branches to start a fire. Around them, shrill cries echoed from the woods as beasts began to gather like lords at a feast table. They made a small pile of branches and ringed them with stones, and Paul dribbled a little gasoline on the wood. The first match he scraped across a stone flared, fizzled, and went out. That left them with two. Darkness was falling fast.
"Here goes," Paul said tersely.
He scraped the second match across the rock he was kneeling over, his other hand ready to cup the flame. It flared, hissed, and immediately began to die. He quickly held the weakening flame against a stick in the pile of branches, kneeling over it like a savage praying at the altar of a fire spirit.
"Catch, you little bastard," he whispered between clenched teeth. "Come on, catch."
The flame was all but gone, just a tiny glint dancing in the dark. And then there was a pop, as a few drops of the gasoline caught, and flame curled up around the stick like a cat's tongue. The fire sputtered, crackled, and began to grow. Paul added more gas. A gout of flame leapt up, fire jumping from stick to stick. Within another minute, they had heat and light, and they held their stiff hands toward the warmth.
"We'll get there in the morning," Paul said as they shared the dried squirrel meat. The stuff tasted like boiled leather. "I'll bet we've only got about another mile."
"Maybe."
She pried the lid off a can of baked beans with the all-purpose knife and scooped some out with her fingers. They were oily and had a metallic taste, but seemed okay. She gave the can to Paul.
"I just hope this kitty compass works. If it doesn't, we could be walking in circles."
He'd already considered that possibility. But now he shrugged his shoulders and scooped the beans into his mouth. If that compass was one hair off, he realized, they could have already missed Mary's Rest.
"We haven't gone 7 miles yet," he told her, though he wasn't even sure of that. "We'll know tomorrow."
"Right. Tomorrow."
She took first watch while Paul slept next to the fire, and she kept her back against a boulder with the magnum on one side of her and the shotgun on the other. Under its hard carapace of Job's mask, Sister's face rippled with pain. Her cheekbones and jaw were throbbing. The searing pain usually passed within a few minutes, but this time it intensified to a point where Sister had to lower her head and stifle a moan. Again, for the 7th or 8th time in the last few weeks,
She felt sharp, cracking jolts that seemed to run deep within the Job's mask, down through the bones of her face. All she could do was clench her teeth and endure the pain until it passed, and when it was finally gone, it left her shivering in spite of the fire. "That was a bad one," she thought. "The pains are getting worse." She lifted her head and ran her fingers across the Job's mask. The knotty surface was as cool as ice on the slopes of a dormant volcano, but beneath it, the flesh felt hot and raw. Her scalp was itching maddeningly, and she put her hand under the hood of her parka to touch the massive growths that encased her skull and trailed down the back of her neck. She longed to dig her fingers through the crust and scratch her flesh until it bled. "Slap a wig on my bald head," she thought, "and I'd still look like a graduate of gargoyle school." She balanced precariously between tears and laughter for a few seconds, but the laughter won out. Paul sat up. "Is it my watch yet?" "No. Couple of hours to go." He nodded, lay back down, and was asleep again almost at once. She continued to probe the Job's mask. "Feels like my skin's on fire underneath there, whatever skin I've got left," she thought. Sometimes when the pain was acute and her flesh beneath the Job's mask felt like it was boiling, she could almost swear that the bones shifted like the foundations of an unsteady house. She could almost swear that she felt her face changing. A glimpse of movement on the right brought her attention back to the business of survival. Something made a deep, guttural barking noise off in the distance. And another beast replied with a sound like that of a baby crying. She laid the shotgun across her lap and looked up at the sky. Nothing but darkness up there, and a sensation of low-hanging clouds like the black ceiling of a claustrophobic's nightmare. She couldn't remember when she'd last seen the stars. Maybe it had been on a warm summer's night when she was living in a cardboard box in Central Park, or maybe she'd stopped noticing the stars a long time before the clouds had blanked them out. She missed the stars. Without them, the sky was dead. Without them, what was there to make a wish on? Sister held her hands toward the fire, shifted against the boulder to get more comfortable. A hotel suite this was not, but her legs weren't aching so much now. She realized how tired she was, and she doubted she could have continued another 50 yards. But the fire felt good, and she had a shotgun across her lap, and she would blast hell out of anything that came within range. She put her hand on the satchel and traced the glass ring's outline. "Tomorrow," she thought, "tomorrow we'll know." She leaned her head against the rock and watched Paul sleeping. "Good for you," she thought. "You deserve it." The fire's soft heat soothed her. The forest was silent, and Sister's eyes closed. "Just for a minute," she told herself. "It won't do any harm if I just rest for a..." She sat bolt upright. Before her, the fire was down to a few red embers, and the cold was slipping through her clothes. Paul was huddled up, still sleeping. "Oh, Jesus," she thought as panic snapped at her. "How long was I out?" She was shivering, her joints throbbing with the cold, and she got up to add more branches to the fire. There were only a few small ones left, and as she knelt down and arranged them in the embers, she sensed a quick cat-like movement behind her. The flesh tightened across the back of her neck, and she knew with sickening certainty that she and Paul were no longer alone. Something was behind her, crouched on a boulder, and she'd left both weapons where she was sitting. She took a deep breath, made up her mind to move, turned, and lunged for the shotgun. She picked it up and spun around to fire. The figure sitting cross-legged atop the boulder lifted his gloved hands in mock surrender. A rifle lay across his knees, and he was wearing a familiar patched brown coat with a cowl protecting his head. "Hope you enjoyed your nap," Robin Oakes said.
"What is it?" Paul sat up, blinking. "Huh?"
"Young man," Sister said hoarsely, "I was about 1 second from sending you to a much warmer place than this. How long have you been sitting there?"
"Long enough so that you ought to be glad I don't have 4 legs. If one person goes to sleep, the other has to keep watch or you're both dead." He looked at Paul. "And by the time you woke up, you'd be bobcat meat. I thought you two knew what you were doing."
"We're okay."
Sister took her finger off the trigger and put the weapon aside. Her insides felt like quivering jelly.
"Sure."
He glanced over his shoulder and called toward the forest.
"Come on in."
3 bundled up figures emerged from the woods and scrambled up onto the boulder with Robin. All of the boys carried rifles, and one of them lugged another of the canvas bags that Robin's highwaymen had stolen from Sister.
"You two didn't make such a good distance, did you?" Robin asked her. "I thought we did damn fine."
Paul was shaking the last of the sleep out of his head.
"I figure we've got about another mile in the morning."
Robin grunted disdainfully.
"More like 3, most likely. Anyway, I sat down and started thinking, back at the cave. I knew you'd make camp somewhere, probably screw that up, too."
He appraised the boulders and the wall of snow.
"You've got yourselves trapped in here.
When that fire went down, the things in the woods would have jumped you from all sides. We saw a lot of them, but we stayed downwind and low to the ground, and they didn't see us."
"Thanks for the warning," Sister said.
"Oh, we didn't come out here to warn you. We followed you to keep you from getting killed." Robin climbed down the boulder, and the other boys did the same. They stood around the fire, warming their hands and faces.
"It wasn't hard. You left a trail that looked like a plow had gone through."
"Anyway, you forgot something." He opened the other duffel bag, reached into it, and brought out the second jug of moonshine that Hugh had given Paul.
"Here." He tossed it to Sister. "I think there's enough left for everybody to have a swig."
There was, and the moonshine's fire heated Sister's belly. Robin sent the 3 boys out to stand guard around the camp.
"The trick is to make a lot of noise," Robin said after they'd gone. "They don't want to shoot anything, because the blood would drive the other animals crazy out there."
He sat down beside the fire, pulled his hood back, and took his gloves off.
"If you want to sleep, Sister, you'd better do it now. We'll have to relieve them on watch before light." "Who put you in charge?"
"I did." The firelight threw shadows in the hollows of his face, glinted off the fine hairs of his beard. His long hair, still full of feathers and bones, made him look like a savage prince.
"I've decided to help you get to Mary's Rest."
"Why?" Paul asked. He was wary of the boy, didn't trust him worth a damn.
"What's in it for you?"
"Maybe I want some fresh air. Maybe I want to travel." His gaze flicked toward Sister's satchel.
"Maybe I want to see if you find who you're looking for. Anyway, I pay my debts. You people helped me with one of mine, and I owe you. So I'll get you to Mary's Rest in the morning, and we'll call it even, right?"
"Okay," Sister agreed. "And thank you.
Besides, if you two get killed tomorrow, I want the glass ring. You won't be needing it." He leaned against the boulder and closed his eyes.
"You'd better sleep while you can."
A rifle shot echoed from the woods, followed by 2 more. Sister and Paul looked at each other uneasily, but the young highwayman lay motionless and undisturbed. The noise of rifle fire continued intermittently for another minute or so, followed by the angry shrieks of what sounded like several animals. But their cries were fading as they retreated. Paul reached for the moonshine jug to coax out the last drops, and Sister leaned back to contemplate tomorrow. Chapter 63.
"Fire! Fire!"
The bombs were falling again, the earth erupting into flames, humans burning like torches under a blood-red sky.
Fire! Something's on fire!
Josh shook loose from his nightmare. He could hear a man's voice shouting,
Fire!
Out in the street. At once he was on his feet and striding to the door. He threw it open, looked out, and saw an orange glow reflected off the clouds. The street was empty, but Josh could hear the man's voice off in the distance raising the alarm.
Fire! Something's on fire! What is it? What's on fire?
Glory's face was stricken as she peered out the door beside him. Aaron, who couldn't be separated from Crybaby, pushed between them to see.
I don't know. What's over in that direction?
Nothing, she said. Just the pit and...
She stopped suddenly, because both of them knew. The barn where Josh had left Mule was on fire. He pulled his boots on, put on his gloves and his heavy coat. Glory and Aaron raced to bundle up as well. Red embers burned in the stove's grate, and Rusty was stirring up from his bed of rags. His eyes were still dazed, and cloth bandages were plastered to the side of his face and the wound at his shoulder.
Josh, he said, what's going on?
The barn's on fire. I locked the door, Rusty. Mule can't get out.
Rusty stood up, but his legs were weak, and he staggered against the wall. He felt like a deballed bull, and he was furious at himself. He tried again, but still didn't have the strength to even get his damned boots on.
No, Rusty, Josh said. He motioned toward Swan, who lay on the floor under the thin blanket that Aaron had given up. You stay with her.
Rusty knew he'd collapse before he got 10 paces from the shack. He almost wept with frustration, but he knew also that Swan needed to be watched over. He nodded and sank down wearily to his knees. Aaron darted on ahead, and Josh and Glory followed as fast as they could. Josh found some of the speed he had once shown on the football field at Auburn University in making the 200 yards between the shack and the barn. Other people were out in the street running toward the fire as well, not because they wanted to extinguish it, but because they could get warm. Josh's heart almost cracked. Over the roar of the flames that covered all but the structure's roof, he could hear Mule's frantic cries. Glory screamed,
Josh, no!
As he barreled at the barn door. Swan said something in a soft, delirious voice, but Rusty couldn't make it out. She tried to sit up, and he put his hand on her shoulder to restrain her. Touching her was like putting his hand to the stove's grate.
Hold on, he said. Easy now. Just take it easy.
She spoke again, but her speech was unintelligible. He thought she said something about corn, though that was all he could even halfway understand. Now the remaining eye hole in the mask of growths was almost sealed over. She'd been fading in and out of consciousness since Josh had brought her in at daylight from the field, and she'd alternately shivered and thrashed free of the blanket. Glory had wound cloth bandages around Swan's raw hands and tried to feed her some watery soup, but there wasn't a thing any of them could do for her now, except try to make her more comfortable. Swan was so far gone, she didn't even know where she was. She's dying, Rusty thought. Dying right in front of me. He eased her back down again, and he heard her say something that might have included Mule.
It's all right, Rusty told her,
his own swollen jaw making speech difficult.
You just rest now. Everything's going to be all right in the morning.
He sure wished he could believe that. He'd come too far with Swan to watch her fade away like this, and he cursed his own weakness. He felt about as sturdy as a wet sponge, and his mama sure hadn't raised him to live on rat meat soup. The only way he could get that stuff down was to pretend it came off the bones of little bitty steers. A loose board popped out on the shack's porch, beyond the closed door. Rusty looked up. He expected either Glory, Aaron, or Josh to enter. But how could that be? They'd just been gone a few minutes. The door didn't open. Another board popped and whined.
Josh?
Rusty called. There was no reply. But he knew someone was standing out there.
He was too familiar with the noise the loose boards made when stepped on, and he'd already sworn he was going to find a hammer and nail somewhere when he got his strength back and tighten those bastards down before they drove him batty.
"Anybody there?" he called.
He realized somebody might be coming to steal the few items Gloria possessed, her needles, her cloth, or even the furniture. Maybe the hand-crank printing press that occupied a corner of the room.
"Now I've got a gun in here," he lied, and he rose to his feet.
There was no more sound of movement beyond the door. He walked to it on unsteady legs. The door was unlatched. He reached for the latch, and he sensed a terrible, gnawing cold on the other side of the door, a dirty cold. He started to slip the latch home.
"Rusty,"
he heard Swan rasp. The entire door suddenly crashed inward, tearing off its wooden hinges and catching him squarely on his bad shoulder. He cried out in pain as he was flung backward and to the floor halfway across the room. A figure stood in the doorway, and Rusty's first impulse was to leap to his feet to protect Swan. He got as far as his knees before the agony of his reopened shoulder wound made him pitch forward on his face. The man walked in, a pair of muddy hiking boots clumping on the floor. His gaze swept the room, saw the wounded man lying in spreading blood, the thinner figure curled up and shivering, obviously near death. And there it was, over in the corner, the printing press. That wasn't a good thing, he decided when the flies had brought him back images and voices from all over Mary's Rest. No, not good at all. First you had a printing press, and then you had a newspaper, and after that you had opinions and people thinking and wanting to do things. And then, he thought, you were right back to the situation that had gotten the world where it was right now. Oh, no, not good at all. They had to be saved from making the same mistake twice, had to be saved from themselves, and that was why he'd decided to destroy the printing press before anything was printed on it. That thing was as dangerous as a bomb, and they didn't even realize it. And that horse was dangerous, too, he'd reasoned. A horse made people think about traveling and wheels and cars, and that led right up to air pollution and wrecks, didn't it? They'd thank him for setting the barn on fire, because they could eat cooked horse meat in just a little while. He was glad he'd come to Mary's Rest, and just in time, too. He'd seen them come to town in their traveling show wagon. Had heard that big one hollering for a doctor. Some people just had no respect for a quiet, peaceful town. Well, respect was going to be taught right now. His boots clumped toward Swan. Josh hit the flaming barn door with the full force of 250 pounds, Glory's scream still ringing in his head. For a bone-jarring second, he thought he was back on the football field and had run smack dab into one of those huge linebackers. He thought the door wasn't going to give, but then the wood split and the barn door caved in, carrying him into the midst of an inferno. He rolled away from burning timbers and got to his feet. Smoke churned before his face, and the awful heat almost crushed him. "Mule!" he shouted. He could hear the horse bucking and shrieking, but couldn't see him. Flames leapt at him like spears, and fire was starting to fall like orange confetti from the roof. He charged toward Mule's stall, his coat beginning to smolder, and the smoke took him. "My, my," the man said softly. He stopped just past the thin figure on the floor, his attention drawn to an object on the pine wood table. He reached out with a slender hand and picked up a mirror with two carved faces on the handle, each looking in a different direction. He intended to admire the new face he'd created, but the glass was dark. A finger traced the carved faces. What kind of mirror had a black glass, he wondered, and his new mouth twitched just a fraction. This mirror gave him the same sensation as the ring of glass. It was a thing that should not be. What was its purpose, and what was it doing here? He didn't like it, not at all. He lifted his arm and smashed the mirror to pieces against the table, and then he twisted the double-faced handle and flung it aside. Now he felt so much better. But there was another object on the table, too. A small leather pouch. He picked it up and shook its contents into his palm. A little kernel of corn, stained red with dried blood, fell out.
"What is this?"
he whispered. A few feet away, the figure on the floor quietly moaned. He gripped the kernel in his hand and slowly turned toward the sound, his eyes red and gleaming in the low firelight. His gaze lingered on the figure's bandaged, clawed hands. A swirl of heat shimmered around the man's right fist, and from within it there was a muffled pop. He opened his hand and pushed the bit of popcorn into his mouth, chewing thoughtfully on it. He'd seen this figure yesterday after he'd watched their wagon being torn apart. Yesterday, the hands had not been bandaged. Why were they bandaged now? Why? Across the room, Rusty lifted his head and tried to focus. He saw a tall, slender man in a brown parka approaching Swan. Saw him standing over her. Pain racked him, and he was lying in a puddle of blood. Gonna pass out again, he knew. Gotta move. Gotta move. He began crawling through his blood. His good eye almost blinded by the smoke, Josh saw a swirl of movement ahead. It was Mule, panicked, rearing and bucking, unable to find a way out. The blanket on his back was smoking, about to burst into flames. He ran to the horse and was almost trampled under Mule's hooves as the horse frantically reared and came down again, twisting in one direction and then the other. Josh could only think of one thing to do. He lifted both hands in front of the horse's muzzle and clapped them together as hard as he could, like he'd seen Swan do at the Jaspin farm. Whether the noise brought Swan to mind or just snapped his panic for a second, Mule stopped thrashing and stood steady, his eyes watering and wide with terror. Josh wasted no time. He grabbed Mule's mane and pulled him out of the stall, trying to lead him to the door. Mule's legs stiffened.
"Come on, you dumb fool!"
Josh yelled, the heat scorching his lungs. He planted his boots in burning straw, his joints cracking as he hauled Mule forward. Pieces of flaming wood fell from above, striking him on the shoulders and hitting Mule's flanks. Cinders spun before his face like hornets. And then Mule must have gotten a whiff of outside air, because he lunged so fast Josh only had time to throw his arms around the horse's neck. His boots were dragged across the floor as Mule powered through the flames. They burst through the opening where the barn door had been, out into the cold night air, with sparks trailing from Josh's burning coat and the flames in Mule's mane and tail. The man in the brown parka stood looking at those bandaged hands.
"What have y'all been up to while my back's been turned?"
he asked in a deep south drawl. The printing press was forgotten for the moment. A mirror that showed no reflection, a single kernel of corn, bandaged hands, those things bothered him, just like the glass ring did, because he didn't understand them. And there was something else, too, something about the figure on the floor. What was it? This is a nothing, he thought, a less than zero, a piece of shit passing through the sewage pipe of Mary's Rest. But why did he sense something different about this figure, something threatening? He lifted his right hand. Heat shimmered through the fingers. One of them burst into flame, and the flame spread. In another few seconds, his hand was a glove of fire. The solution to things he did not understand was very simple. Destroy it. He began to reach down toward the growth-encrusted head.
No!
It was a weak whisper, but the hand that clamped around the man's ankle still had strength in it. The man in the brown parka looked at him incredulously, and by the light of the flaming hand, Rusty saw his face. heavily seamed and weather-beaten, a thick gray beard, eyes that were so blue they were almost white. Touching the man sent freezing waves through Rusty's bones, and he wanted more than anything on earth to draw his hand back, but the cold shocked his nerves and kept him from passing out. Rusty said,
"No. Don't you touch Swan, you bastard."
He saw the man smile faintly. It was a pitying smile, but then it passed the point of pity. The man reached down and clamped his burning hand to Rusty's throat, and Rusty's neck was encircled with a noose of fire. The man lifted him off the floor as Rusty screamed and kicked, and the fire pumped out of that hand and arm like napalm, sizzling Rusty's hair and eyebrows. His clothes caught, and he realized at a cold center within his pain and panic that he was becoming a human torch, and that he had only seconds to live. And then after him, it would be Swan's turn. Rusty's body jerked and fought, but he knew he was finished. The smell of himself afire made him think of the greasy French fries at the Oklahoma State Fair when he was a kid. The flame was going bone deep now, and as his nerves began to sputter, the pain locked up as if a point of no return had been passed. Mama said something, Rusty thought. Mama said, "Fight fire with fire." Rusty embraced the man with the burning sticks of his arms, entwining his fingers at the man's back. The fingers melted like chains, and Rusty thrust his flaming face into the man's beard. The beard caught fire. The face bubbled, melting and running like a plastic mask, exposing a deeper layer the color of modeling clay. Rusty and the man whirled around the room like participants in a bizarre ballet.
"Lord God!" shouted one of two men who were looking in, drawn by the open doorway on their jaunt to the burning barn. "Lord God Almighty!" the second man screamed, backed up, and fell on his rump in the mud. Other people were running over to see what was happening, and the man in the burning rags of a brown parka could not thrust the flaming dead man away from him, and his new disguise was ruined, and they were about to see his true face. He gave a garbled roar that almost shook the cabin and ran through the doorway out into the midst of them. He was still roaring as he ran up the street on melting legs in the embrace of a charred cowboy. Glory helped Josh pull out of his burning coat. His ski mask was smoking too, and before she could think twice about it, she reached up and yanked it off. Dark gray growths, some the size of Aaron's fists, almost completely covered Josh's face and head. Tendrils had interlocked around his mouth, and the only clear area, except for his lips, was a circle in the crust through which his left eye, now bloodshot from the smoke, stared at Glory. His condition wasn't as bad as Swan's, but it still made Glory gasp and retreat a step. He had no time to apologize for not being a beauty. He ran for Mule, who was bucking wildly as other onlookers scattered, and grabbed up a handful of snow. He clutched Mule's neck and crushed out the flames in his mane. Then Glory had a handful of snow and was pressing it to the horse's tail, and Aaron had some too, and many of the other men and women were scooping up snow and rubbing it against Mule's sides. A thin, dark-haired man with a blue keloid grabbed Mule's neck opposite Josh, and after a minute of struggle, they got the horse calmed down enough to stop bucking.
"Thanks," Josh told the man. And then there was a roaring and a rush of heat, and the barn's roof fell in.
"Hey!" a woman standing closer to the road called out. "There's some kind of commotion back there." She pointed toward the shacks, and both Glory and Josh could see people out in the street. Shouts and cries for help drifted to them.
"Swan," Josh thought. "Oh, God, I left Swan and Rusty alone."
He started to run, but his legs betrayed him, and he went down. His lungs were grabbing for air, black motes spinning before his eyes. Someone took his arm, started helping him up. A second person supported his other shoulder, and together
They got Josh to his feet. Josh realized Glory stood on one side of him, and on the other was an old man with a face like cracked leather.
"I'm all right," he told them, but he had to lean heavily on Glory. She stood firm and started guiding him along the road.
A blanket had been thrown to the ground about 30 feet from Glory's shack. Smoke curled from under it. A few people stood around it, motioning and talking. Others were crowded around Glory's front door. Josh smiled.